All right, we're ready for Matthew chapter 5 in our studies. We've looked at this little diagram each time and will continue to do so, of dividing the ministry of Jesus into the after his childhood. We have the early Judean ministry, and then we're into the Galilean ministry. And this is how Matthew plugs into that. We are right here in the Galilean ministry, and we'll be there till we get to chapter 18 and verse 35. So we will not get out of the Galilean ministry for a while. So we're going to be around Galilee for a good while in the book of Matthew. This is our outline of the book of Matthew. We are right here in the Galilean ministry, and as Baxter outlines that in three sections, that is, the Galilean ministry in three sections, what he taught and what he wrought and what the people thought, that is, his teaching and his miracles and the reaction of the people. And so we're in the teaching section in the Sermon on the Mount. Quickly, let's review where we've been. We won't do this every time, but chapter 1 was about genealogy and the birth of Jesus. Chapter 2, visit of the wise men and the massacre of the children. Chapter 3, baptism of Jesus, John the Baptist and baptism of Jesus. Chapter 4, the temptation. And that's where we begin the Galilean ministry. And so that's good to remember that, so that when you're thinking 3 months, 3 years from now, and we're not in the book of Matthew, and you're thinking about where did the Galilean ministry begin in Matthew, Matthew 4 is where that begins. Where does it end? Chapter 18, verse 35. All right, let's talk about the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is found in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. This is the greatest sermon that was ever preached by the greatest preacher there ever was. I don't think anyone can deny that statement. Furthermore, it is the longest recorded sermon of Jesus, and it is the longest recorded sermon in the New Testament. And so this is a significant sermon. It is not found in Mark or in John. A parallel account is found in Luke, though Luke doesn't give as full an account of that. Luke only records 30 verses given to the Sermon on the Mount, and Matthew some 107 verses. So they are the same sermon, though some have denied that, but they are different accounts. The scene for the Sermon on the Mount is the mountain near Galilee. And we can't be a lot more specific than that. We'll be a little more, but not a lot more than that. The parallel account in Luke 6:12 said, Jesus went into the mountain to pray, and then after his prayer, he chose his apostles, and then the text words it later in the text, they came down with him. And they came, and then it starts the Sermon on the Mount. So they've come down from a higher portion of the mountain from where the prayer was offered. Tradition says that it was somewhere between Mount Tabor and Tiberias, the city of Tiberias near the Sea of Galilee, though we don't know that for sure. But when the sermon is over in Matthew chapter 7, chapter 18, verse 5, says he entered the city of Capernaum. Luke's account says the same thing in Luke 7 and in verse 1. So we assume it was near Capernaum. Do we know that 100%? No. It could have been a good distance, and when he finished his sermon, then he travels a good distance, but we would assume that it must be near Capernaum. Luke says he came to a level place, meaning he's on the mountain and he's coming down, and it is called the Sermon on the Mount, that while he's on the mountain, there is a level place somewhere, and he sat down, according to Matthew's account, in verse 1. Now, this is the Sea of Galilee right here, obviously, and Mount Tabor and Tiberias. Tradition says it was probably somewhere here. Most think it was probably closer somewhere near Capernaum, exactly where we do not know, but near the Sea of Galilee. Now, what's the message of that? I think we had a question on that. The message, the main point of the sermon, maybe we didn't, and the message of the sermon is the kingdom of God. Now, how do I know that? Last week, we flagged a verse. Verse 23 of chapter 4, he's going out everywhere preaching the gospel of the kingdom. That is this message. This is the gospel of the kingdom. In fact, everything he taught is the gospel of the kingdom. But this is about the kingdom. Now, all throughout, I'm not going to flag this each time, and if I think of it as we go through, I'll say there's the verse that mentions the kingdom. But watch for it yourself as we're going through the sermon, not only today, but next week as well. Watch for how many times he mentions the kingdom. It's a pretty good indication if you read a sermon of someone in the present day, a transcript of his sermon, and here's a word he keeps using over and over and over and over and over again, but you don't know what the title of the sermon is, you got an idea of what the sermon's about by looking at the words that are repeated on and on and on. Kingdom does that several times, 5 and 3, 5 and 10, 5 and 19, and on down the line. So that's the message of the sermon. Now, who's in the audience? Well, the disciples are there, chapter 5, verse 1 of Matthew, but Luke's account says there was a multitude there. So which was it? Both. There was a multitude, among them the disciples. So it's not only the disciples hearing this, there's the multitude. And out on the peripherals, perhaps, there are some of the Pharisees that he's going to sting with some things a little bit later in the sermon, beginning at verse 21. All right. Here is an outline of the Sermon on the Mount. I'm outlining not only chapter 5, but putting 6 and 7 as if this were the outline from which Jesus would have preached the sermon. There are three major points, and that is he talks about the citizens of the kingdom, and then he talks about the righteousness of the kingdom, and then he talks about the exhortation to enter the kingdom. We call that the invitation section, not just at the end, if you'd like to enter the kingdom, respond now, but here is the plea in this third section to enter into this kingdom. Now, we're going to focus primarily on the first and then part of the second, halfway through the second. The citizens, what kind of people make up this kingdom? What are their characteristics? What's their influence? And then we'll talk about the righteousness of this kingdom a little bit later. So let's go to our questions. Question number one, what's the main point of chapter 5? In one sentence, what would you say? All right. Involves the Sermon on the Mount. It is. Yeah, characteristics of the citizens of the kingdom, particularly the first 12 verses. So what kind of people make up this kingdom? What kind of people are going to be in this kingdom? What's the nature of the people in this kingdom? This is what we're going to begin to see. We'll come back to our questions here in a moment. So let's start right here with the characteristics. We often refer to these characteristics as the Beatitudes. That word just simply means blessings. Blessed are those, blessed are those, or blessed are those who do this and those who do that, etc. These are the ones that God blesses, and the blessing is they are in the kingdom. Now, he pronounces a blessing upon them, and we'll go through each one of these. There are 8 of these that are listed in the context. Blessed are the poor in spirit, and they that mourn, and meek, and hunger and thirst, etc. And so let's take each one of them and just get the gist, because if we camp on the Beatitudes, we'll never get through the rest of chapter 5. Now, this was a sermon that was presented in one setting. We're going to take 2 settings. But if you'd been in the audience, you would have heard this sermon in one setting. And that's how Jesus presented that. So we'll work our way through this. Let's talk about poor in spirit. Question number 2, what is poor in spirit, or what does that mean? All right, it involves humility. Say again. Yeah, they need spiritual help. Notice he's poor, but he's poor in spirit. That is, he is completely destitute, has abject poverty. He recognizes that he is spiritually poor. He has spiritual poverty. He recognizes his need. The kind of people that enter the kingdom are people who first of all recognize, you know what? I am terribly in sin and I need the Lord. I need forgiveness. You're not going to enter the kingdom coming in saying, you know what? I'm a pretty good fella and I think I have a lot to offer to this kingdom. I'd like to enter into your kingdom, Lord, because I've just got so much goodness about me. You're not going to get in this kingdom. And so he begins with abject poverty. Now, the blessing is, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I just simply think that means they're the kind of people who enter the kingdom. They're blessed. All right? What's the next one there? Blessed are they that... What does that mean? Question 3. Yeah, they mourn for that sinful state. Yes. They're mourning for the sin. This is deep sorrow, deep repentance, contrition here. And they shall be comforted, not because they're simply in sorrow, But the idea of them being comforted means that their burden is lifted. Those who enter the kingdom are those who mourn for their sin, and their mourning is comforted because their burden of sin is lifted. I've got this great burden, and I recognize how terrible I am in sin, and so I'm bringing it to the Lord, and it's lifted. All right, the third one is blessed are the meek. Now, what does the word meek suggest to you? Say again. Gentleness, the discipline. There is not a one-word synonym to the word that is translated meek that encompasses everything that's involved in meekness. So it's a word that when we take it, does it refer to gentleness? Yeah. Does it refer to humility? Yes. Does it refer to being disciplined? Does it refer to self-control? Yeah, all of that. So it encompasses a number of things. It does involve this idea of self-control, discipline, and I think in the context of being poor in spirit, mourning and hungering and thirst, that he suppresses his own will and yields to the will of God. I think a parallel would be in Acts chapter 24 when Felix was told concerning righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. You're going to have to suppress your will and yield to the will of God. And so it means he's disciplined, he's self-controlled, he submits, willing to submit to God, he's meek. Now, one of the more controversial phrases or difficult phrases is, they shall inherit the earth. And what does that mean, and in what sense do they inherit the earth? Well, what's interesting is that same phrase is found in Psalm 25 and also Psalm 37, found in verse 9, verse 11, and verse 22. Probably he's alluding to the Psalm 37 and in verse 9 or 11, One of those verses is probably what he's referring to when he said the meek shall inherit the earth, because almost an identical phrase is found there. So how is it used in Psalm 37? It's used in Psalm 37 to include the blessing of this life. As they go into the land and occupy the land, they'll inherit the earth. Not literally inherit and now I own this section of the earth, but they enjoy the blessings of the land in contrast to their enemies whom God would defeat. That's how it's used in Psalm 37. And it could allude to also the eternal life. Now, Thayer says that phrase, I won't read all of this, it alluded to the concept of the Israelites taking possession of the land. The first underlying phrase is what I wanted to focus on. It came to pass that the phrase was transferred to denote the tranquil and stable possession of the Holy Land crowned with all divine blessings. I don't think that's saying you're going to enter the Holy Land of Israel, the physical Israel. You're going to go to Canaan if you are meek. But just as they inherited that land and enjoyed the blessings of the land, so you're going to enjoy the blessings of God, that God will provide blessings for you in contrast to your enemies. That's the best I can do with that. It has to harmonize somehow with Psalm 37. You say, why? Because that seems to be where he's quoting from. That seems to be, he's using a phrase from there. And how was it used in Psalm 37, Psalm 25, etc.? Make sense? Otherwise, we're going to come up with some difficult explanation. Now, let's talk about hungering and thirsting after righteousness, verse 6. What does that mean? Yeah, he craves to be right with God. Because he recognizes his abject poverty, mourning for his sin, willing to submit to God, he's craving to be right with God. It's not like, I guess I could join the kingdom if you want me to. I don't really need it. No, he wants to be right. He's craving to be right with God. And they shall be filled. In what sense? Yeah. If you're hungering and then you're filled, you're satisfied, right? If you're dying of hunger and then you're filled, your request, your craving has been satisfied. You want to be right with God? That's going to be satisfied. You'll be right with God. And your relationship with God is now right. Now he shifts gears, and you'll see us shifting gears in just a moment. Let's just assume we're shifting gears. But at number 5, blessed are the merciful. These are people who show mercy and compassion and sympathy, or they care. And they receive mercy from God and from others. They shall receive mercy. So you show mercy, you receive mercy. God's going to be merciful, of course, to you. The pure in heart, I think, has to do with sincerity. I don't think it refers to their heart has become pure. Maybe so, 1 Peter 1:22, maybe. But it probably refers to sincerity. and they shall see God. Not in the sense that they're going to lay eyes upon God. No man has seen God at any time, the text says. But they see God in the sense that they enjoy a relationship with God. They're going to have a harmonious relationship with God because they are utterly sincere. And if you want to put in there their hearts become pure, put that there and make that work. The peacemakers are those who seek peace with God and seek peace with others. They're easygoing rather than those who want to rebel against God, rebel against people. They seek a peaceful relationship with people and with their God, and they are the children of God. I don't think it just means now you're a child of God, you're a Christian, that's included, but being a child of the devil, if I called you that, you wouldn't like that because that implies you're like the devil. And Jesus used it that way in John 8. To say you're a child of God means you take on the characteristics of God. And I think that's what he means here. They're God's children and they take on his characteristics. You're like God if you are a peacemaker because God seeks peace with his enemies. Make sense? All right. And then blessed are those who persecute you. These are suffering for the righteousness' sake. I think it gives the idea they're willing to pay the cost. Now, not everyone who enters the kingdom will end up willing to pay the cost. Some throw up their hands and quit. But I think Jesus is flagging at the very beginning, this kingdom, let me tell you, before you get in, before you decide to enter, you may suffer being a part of this kingdom. Just get ready. Those in this kingdom need to be willing to pay the price. You're going to suffer along the way. You're going to be ridiculed. Let's notice what he says at verse 11. They'll say all manner of evil against you. They'll persecute you and they'll revile you. You're going to suffer if you're in this kingdom. So those in my kingdom, Jesus is saying, we'll have to pay the price. And what's the blessing? Well, he said, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They enter the kingdom both now and eternally. Now, I said we shifted gears. Here's why. The first four of those seem to be focusing on things that are essential to gain citizenship. In other words, you can't get in this kingdom unless you recognize your poverty, you mourn, you're meek, you hunger and thirst for righteousness. The next four seem to focus on maintaining citizenship. Those that are in the kingdom are merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, etc. Make sense? The first four focus on a new attitude toward ourselves and a new attitude toward God. I'm now looking at myself as a sinner in need of salvation, and I'm looking at God as the one I need to turn to. The last four focus on a new attitude toward others. I'm merciful, I'm sincere, etc., peacemaker, and I'm going to be persecuted and I'm not going to rebel. Make sense? All right. Let's shift gears again now. We're still talking about the citizens of the kingdom. What two things does he say about their influence? He compares it to two things. Salt and light. Here's the first, verse 13. Salt. Salt does two things. What does salt do? It preserves, it stays the rot, and it also serves as flavor. And it could be used in both senses here. The citizens of the kingdom stay the rot by our example, by our teaching. So through our influence and us carrying the gospel to other people, we help preserve society. We help stay the rot of society. Secondly, Christianity adds flavor to life. It doesn't rob life of flavor. It gives flavor to life. But more confusing, I think, is at verse 13, the salt, what if it loses its flavor? And so there's commentaries, if you exhausted what commentaries you may have, you spend a good time doing that. They go in several directions here. And so some say we're talking about something impossible. Some say, no, it is impossible with certain types of salt from the land. The general idea seems to be that of salt becoming polluted or contaminated, maybe. We're going to come out at the same spot, whatever one of these positions the commentators take. Barclay suggests that some of the outdoor ovens use salt beds under tiles that in time would become polluted, and then they had to finally throw it out because it's just useless. It's not that the salt doesn't have salty taste to it anymore. It's just so polluted, you can't use it anymore, so you throw it away. And so the point would be, don't ever lose your effectiveness. Never become worldly. That's the idea. That the citizens of this kingdom are like salt. They stay the rot. They preserve. Make sense? Don't ever lose your influence. Now, Linsky suggests, and I won't read all of this, that maybe we're talking about something impossible, that salt never loses its saltiness. It's always salt. And if it did, which is impossible, he says, then there's nothing that you can buy to put salt back in salt. And so the point is, not that it's impossible to lose your saltiness as a Christian, but that he uses something impossible to make a point. I'm not sure about Linsky. I just pass that on for what it's worth. This is a little easier to understand. What's his second illustration? Your light. Light dispels darkness and enables people to see. I think it's parallel to the good works mentioned at verse 16. Flag that if you're underlining things. I like what Barclay said. This text doesn't say that he's the light of the church, but the light of the world. In other words, our light is not to shine right here in this building, and then nobody else sees that. It needs to shine to the world. That is, you as an individual, me as an individual. Now, so when men see at verse 16 our good works, the result is they glorify God. See, men are not going to turn and glorify God because they're convinced you teach the right doctrine. That's important. I'm not minimizing that. They're going to be impressed because of your life. Does that make sense? And that life that you live may lead them to be impressed with the doctrine that you believe and teach. But they're probably not going to come say, I want to go to church with you because I hear y'all take the Lord's Supper every Sunday. Maybe. But they're probably going to go to church with you because they see you're consistent with what you claim to teach. That's what Jesus is talking about. Makes sense? All right. Now, I know we're moving along, but we've got a long sermon and we're only going to get halfway through that. Now he shifts gears. These are the citizens of the kingdom. Now he talks about how the righteousness of the kingdom, and his first subpoint here is this harmonizes with the Old Testament. Now, at verse 17a, what did he say? I did not come to abolish the law. Or to destroy the law and the prophets. Yet Colossians 2, said he did come to abolish the law. Must be talking about different senses. He came to take the law away in the sense it's no longer effective, Colossians 2. But let's go back here. What Jesus is saying here is I did not come to oppose or refute the law or to set aside or disregard the law, but rather I came, verses 17 and 18, to fulfill that. It's much like a contract. If you have a contract with a man to build your house, the contract is binding, and you're under that contract as the contractor and as the owner or the builder of the house until the contract is completed, and then you're no longer under the contract. So he's saying, I didn't come to do away with this contract. I came to fulfill and complete it. Does that make sense? Now, notice at verse 17 or 18 that heaven and earth would not pass until every jot and tittle has been fulfilled. That is, every minute detail of the law. So I came to fulfill the law. He is the fulfillment of the law, is the point. Now verse 19, in fact, not only is he not disregarding the law, but he demands respect for every command of the law. So what does he say? Well, he says, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so, he's the least in the kingdom. In other words, if you don't respect the commands of God, and at the time he's speaking, the Old Testament is still in force. And then when the New Testament becomes effective and is in law, then it's in force. Whoever disrespects any command of God, he said he's the least in the kingdom. So here's the point. Let's get the overall picture. That what I'm teaching in this kingdom is not disregard for the Old Testament. I came to fulfill it. In fact, I teach respect for every command of God, Old or New Testament, when they're in force. Make sense? Now, this is where we're going to spend the rest of our time here. And that is, now he says, my law goes further than the Old Testament. There are six contrasts here in this next section. But his point here is that my law, the righteousness of the kingdom that I'm establishing, goes further than the Old Testament. Now, we've got to say a few things about this context. Number one, is Jesus quoting from the old law and contrasting the old law to what he teaches? Yes. Is Jesus taking some rabbinical interpretation of the law and contrasting that to his teaching? Yes. It's not exclusive one or the other. Now I'll give you some examples as we go along in these six contrasts. If you haven't done this, you might do this as we go along. At verse 22 would be a good place to start. But I say to you. Now, there's two things about that. Number one, I know this is the gospel not of the Old Testament. This is the gospel of the kingdom. I know that because chapter 4, 23 says he's preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And secondly, Jesus quotes from the old law and then he says, but, contrast, I say unto you, this is his law. Now, why do I mention that? Quite a number of people, including brethren, will argue that Matthew 5, in fact, all of teaching of Jesus was an explanation of Old Testament law. This is not New Testament law. And so why do they do that? You say, where does this end up? Look at 5:32. They don't want to be under the marriage law. And so in order to remove that, we've got to shove that back to the Old Testament. So all he's doing is explaining Old Testament law. No, he's not explaining Old Testament law. He's teaching his law. His point is it goes further. So I want us to get the overview. Our time's running close, so I'm going to run through these and see if we can make it through these six, because I want you to see the overview. What Jesus is saying is that I want your righteousness to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. By exceeding, he is not saying, I want you to go further than them. I want you, they on a scale of 1 to 10 went to an 8, I want you to be a 9 or a 10. Not in quantity, but in character, kind, and in nature. I want you to be, your righteousness to exceed. Here's how. You say, well, how do we do that? Right here, doing this. All right, let's take verses 21 to 26. His point here is, it's not just murder that's wrong, it's hatred and animosity that is forbidden. And so he quotes from the Old Testament. You've heard it said, you shall not murder. Well, that was true. That's Old Testament. That was one of the Ten Commandments. And whoever murders is in danger of judgment. I don't think that refers to judgment in the end of time, but he's referring to what the Jews thought. They were concerned more about being in danger of judgment of the local council or the Sanhedrin Council, the larger Supreme Court among the Jews, than they were being in trouble with God. And he said, you've heard that. But I say to you, if you're angry with a brother, he actually talks about three things. Being angry without a cause. Is there a place for anger? Sure. But angry without a cause. He said, I'm more concerned in my kingdom about getting our anger under control. And if you do that, then the murder won't be a problem. Does that make sense? The second thing he says about that is what may be said in anger. I don't have time to develop fully verse 22, but he talks about if one says raka, that means empty head, or fool, that comes from the Greek word more, from which we get our word moron. Moron. That's what he means. That's what fool means, moron. Let's footnote here. I think we're learning from this that Christians have no place of, in anger, calling people stupid, morons, and airheads. You say, well, why do you say that? Verse 22. Just read it. What Jesus is saying is, I'm not just condemning murder in my kingdom. What I'm condemning is this hatred and animosity that is forbidden. Now, we don't have time to develop fully, but I want to look at verse 23, 24, 25, and 26. What's his point here? That reconcile before things get out of hand. Leave your gift at the altar. There's a big discussion among commentators about the altar. I'm not going to go there. We don't have time. But in other words, leaving your gift at the altar means don't worry about your worship till you get your relationship right, and then God will accept your worship. It's going to affect your worship. That's the point. And is it urgent? Well, yeah, it's urgent. Agree with him quickly, verse 25. And verse 26 alludes to a principle of an olden practice, even in our country years ago, I understand. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But at least among the Jews, if someone had a debt they weren't paying, the principal person was put into prison, and his family had to pay the debt, and when the last penny's paid, he could be released. Maybe not a bad practice. And I don't think he's alluding that's what we need to practice. I think that's what he's alluding is the urgency is get your debt settled and your problem settled before you have to pay the penalty for it. Make sense? All right. Now, the second thing is not just adultery, but lust that is forbidden. So he said, you've heard it said, you might underline verse 28, but I say unto you, But a man that looks upon a woman to lust, he's committed adultery already in his heart. Not literally committed adultery, any more than 1 John 3, the man who hates commits murder. He's not guilty of murder. He has the same attitude that leads to murder. This man has the same attitude that leads to adultery. That's the point. Be that as it may, what Jesus is saying is, in my kingdom, it's not just do everything you can, but just stop short of adultery. Just don't go through the overt act. That in my kingdom, it stops back here in looking and lusting. And then his point about plucking out your eye, I don't think he's saying literally take out your eye, but that would be better than losing your soul. And if your hand offends you, that is, if that would stop your stealing, you're better off to cut your hand off than to lose your soul. Isn't that true? But the truth of the matter is, if you're a thief and you cut off your hand, you'll figure out a way to steal without that hand. You'll do that. So the point is, it's better to go to that extreme than to pay the price eternally. Let's go to the third one now. It's not a man for a certificate of divorce, but unjust divorce. That is, you've heard it said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Deuteronomy 24 required that. If he going to divorce, it didn't approve, by the way. Deuteronomy 24 never approved of that. But if you do, there had to be the writing of a certificate of divorce. The Jews were sticklers about that. Let's make sure we get the writing of divorce. And Jesus said, and I'm going to paraphrase, I'm not concerned so much about, my law doesn't concern itself with making sure you get the certificate of divorce, but the unjust divorce is forbidden. Now, this is a little different from Matthew 5. It teaches the same principle, but Matthew 5:32 is focusing on the unjust nature of putting someone away, that you cause her to commit adultery. That is, you bear some responsibility for adultery. Man puts away his wife, and for some cause other than fornication, he is the cause for her being in a position where she's liable to commit adultery because she likely will remarry. That's the point. You're treating her unjust. All right? Let's go further. Verse 33 begins, it's not false oaths, but dishonesty that is forbidden. Now, he said, you've heard it said by those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but perform unto the Lord your oaths. Well, that was taught in the Old Testament. Matthew 23 gives us an insight. The Jews had this concept that I could say anything and I'm not bound by it, but if I swore, depending on what I swear by, if I swear by God, then I'm obligated to do that. If I swear by the temple, it may not be as binding. And so you swear by certain things as to whether you want to be bound by that. Or like telling us something, and I didn't raise my right hand, so I'm not going to be condemned for telling that lie, not unless I raised my right hand. I didn't put my hand on the Bible, so it's okay for me to lie. That's a misconception. Jesus says, do not swear at all. I think that's a general rule to which there are exceptions. Romans 1, Romans 9, Romans 1, 9, and 9, 1. Paul took an oath. Jesus answered a question under oath. I adjure thee by the living God. That's to put one under oath. But I think it's this common oath-taking is what's under consideration. Now, verse 37, let your yes be yes and your no, no. What does that mean? Yeah, be a person of your word. There's a parallel text that says the same thing. Not parallel in the Gospels, it's found elsewhere. James 5, verse 12, says the same thing. You might make a marginal note. Both passages are saying be a person of your word. If you say yes, mean yes. If you say no, mean no. You don't need to be able to say, I'm going to prove this time I'm telling the truth. I swear by the temple, or I swear by God, or I swear by whatever. That idea of these common oaths and false telling, false information, he said, is not acceptable in my kingdom. He said, I'm interested in my kingdom. Dishonesty is forbidden. Then verse 38, not an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. He said, you've heard it said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, that was part of the Old Testament. And you say, well, I thought the Bible taught that. It did. It taught an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You might look up your references in Exodus 21, Leviticus 24, Deuteronomy 19. Those are some references in your center reference column if you've got those. But that was not talking about individual revenge. That was to be executed by the civil government, by the judges were to execute that. So yes, if a man stole, this was to be taken from him, but you don't go get that yourself. Same principle. For example, murders someone in your family, they ought to be put to death. I think Romans 13 tells that. It's not telling you to do that. Romans 13 says the civil government can do that, civil authority can do that. So it was not allowing the person to take individual revenge. But he said, you've heard that said. So Jesus' point here at verse 39, let's get verse 39, and then 40 to 42 can be wrapped together in one thought, that do not resist an evil person. If he slaps you on the right cheek, then turn to him the other also. What he's teaching is a non-retaliatory message. It is not suggesting that if a person slaps you on one side, you need to make sure he gets you on the other side. Or if a person steals your car, make sure before he gets away, I want to give you the key to my truck too. That's not what he's saying. That's not the point. The point is that you do not resist and retaliate. In other words, he does me wrong, I'm not going to be eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I'll let God take care of that through the civil government or however else. I'm not going to retaliate. Now, the point of 41 and 42, if he sues you for your tunic, give him your cloak also. Again, is he saying he's robbed me out here and got a gun on me and he's wanting the keys to my car and my truck is at the neighbor's house, so I want to make sure he gets the key and tell him it's over there. Go be sure and get that one too. No, it's not saying that. What he's saying is it would be better to let him take your cloak also, take your truck also. He's trying to steal $100. He doesn't know about the $500 you got in your shoe. Take it off and give it to him would be better than for you to retaliate. Does that make sense? I might lose my soul for retaliating. I'm not going to lose my soul if I let him take more. It's not saying let him take more. Offer him more. That's not what the point is. The point is don't retaliate. It's a non-retaliatory. So that's the point. You've heard it said an eye for an eye, but I'm telling you, be good to your enemy. Don't retaliate. Don't retaliate. That's not your place. That's the place of wrath. Give place to wrath, Romans 12. Now the last section, and we're about done, is this loving your neighbor only. You've heard it said you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Well, that last phrase is not found in the Old Testament. That was the conclusion of some of the rabbis, that if you love your neighbor as yourself, that means I am to hate my enemy. That's not found in the Scriptures. So here we have Scripture combined with some interpretation, and so Jesus responds to that, and here's what he says. Love your enemies, and bless those who curse you, and do good to those who hate you, and pray for those that despitefully use you. In other words, you need to love everybody. Now, in verse 45... you're going to be the sons of the Father. In what sense? Well, he sends the sun on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust. See, he's good to everybody. Now, let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 48 quickly. Be perfect even as he is perfect. Can you be perfect? You better. This doesn't mean flawless. This means complete. So you might make a marginal note to the side. Verse 48 means complete, and draw a line up to verse 45. Here's your commentary. Verse 45. God didn't just send rain on one. He sent the rains on the good and on the evil. That means God is complete. So you be perfect as the Father's perfect. Not sinless like the Father's sinless. Flawless like the Father is flawless. Complete like he's complete. That's the context. Make sense? We're going to stop there.